Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Sina Bazila Hickey, and today we're bringing you a holiday special of Hudson Mohawk Magazine and highlighting five interviews with authors that took place over the last year. We begin with Elizabeth Colbert, who spoke with Mark Dunley about her new book, looking at the actions of humans threatening our future in Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. Then Renee Powell speaks with Miss Ella Maria LeBlanc about her book, Your Path to True Freedom, 10 Principles to Guide You to Living the Life You Deserve. Later on, A Walk in the Words is Hudson Talbot's newest book, and he spoke with Andrea Cunliffe about how his story relates to his own journey with words. And after that, it's a book about exploitation. Angela Kaufman tells Eileen Javier about her novel, Quiet Man. Finally, Anise is honored in Nyasia's beautiful discovery. Dulcinea Deggs caught up with the author, Ashley Charleston, at a Girls Inc. event. If you are an avid reader, this special episode is for you. You can hear these stories again or share them with your friends by visiting our website, mediasanctuary.org/stories. Our search bar is very good. On our website, you can also find Bria Barthel's Talking with Books segments. Every month, she gives listeners book suggestions by visiting the librarians at Troy Public Library. We begin with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Elizabeth Colbert. She spoke with Mark Dunley about her new book, Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. With the action of humans threatening the future of life on the planet, should humans use technology to try to fix the problems we've created? That's the question.
Elizabeth Colbert, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Sixth Extinction, which talked about the accelerating loss of species on our planet, returns to humanity's transformative impact on the environment under a sky, the nature of the future. As one author posed it, after doing so much damage, can humanity change nature this time to save it? So Elizabeth, what prompted you to write this particular book? You've been writing quite a few years on climate.
Well, I think this is a pretty logical extension of the previous books, you know, the first one on climate change, the second one on biodiversity loss, and this one really on ways in which people are either already or thinking about trying to counteract some of these, you know, major interventions in the natural world with further interventions in the natural world. So it's sort of, I sort of see it as a logical sequel.
Now, I will confess, I've not yet read the book. I do plan to read the book.
But I
have read quite a few reviews of the book. I get the sense that you don't really answer the question in the book as to whether or not this idea that technology, which has contributed to the destruction of the planet, should in fact be used as a way to try to save the planet. And there's a quote in there which says, "We cannot solve our problems with the same thinking we used when we created them." So did you come up with an answer, or is it more of an interesting question and challenge that you want us all to be thinking about?
Yeah, it's definitely more the latter. I mean, I think as we move into this period, which has already been deeper into this period, which has already been dubbed the Anthropocene, you know, this epoch that is defined by human impacts on the planet, we are facing increasingly complicated and difficult choices about what we're going to do to try to deal with some of the impacts that we've already had, the effects of which we don't care for. So I don't, you know, go out and say, this is what we should do. This is not like my 10-point plan for solving all global environmental problems, but I think it raises some pretty important questions.
Now, one of the scientists you interview in the book is you know, looking at ways of changing the coral reefs, basically trying to figure out, can we, you know, change their, I guess, biological makeup so that they can, you know, survive in warmer waters. I guess under the assumption that we've gone too far to actually halt this, we have to really be focusing a little bit more on adaptation. What prompted you to particularly look at this particular situation?
Well, that was actually the story that really set me down the path that led to the book. I went out to visit these scientists in Hawaii a couple of years ago, a few years ago now, who were working on this project that had already been nicknamed the Super Coral Project. And as you say, the idea behind the Super Coral Project was basically that, you know, we've already intervened in the oceans quite dramatically, if unintentionally. We have really altered the oceans. Climate change is warming the oceans very fast. And meanwhile, also, a lot of the CO2 we put up into the air ends up dissolved in the oceans pretty quickly, and that's changing the chemistry of the oceans. And we can already see that corals, reef-building corals, which are these tiny little gelatinous animals that build these enormous structures that are coral reefs, they don't like these changes. And we've seen a lot of mass mortality among corals in the last few decades. And so the idea behind this project was, well, if we want reefs in the future, you know, we're not changing the oceans back. We're not getting that heat out of the oceans or that CO2 out of the oceans in any foreseeable future. So the thinking was, well, we're going to have to try now to manipulate corals so that they are more heat tolerant. And that idea that we were going to, you know, counter one set of interventions with another set of interventions or manipulations, that really struck me as, when I started to think about it, I started to see that pattern everywhere. That was sort of our response to these changes we were seeing.
Now, you know, part of the problem with trying to solve, you know, a problem you created by doing something else often then ends up with even more problems being created than anticipated. And I'll admit, I'm firmly in the camp that those who have created climate change with their mentality are really not the ones we should be looking for guidance on how to solve the problem. It's best to sort of literally remove them, particularly from the marketplace, and bring in a different set of feelings. Yeah. So somebody like me, you know, are there examples in the book which you say, well, here's one you should really think about because it, you know, sort of poses the question with possibly a different answer?
Well, I think that, we should talk after you read the book, Mark. I mean, I think that you'll find when you read the book that many of the examples pose pretty hard choices. And, you know, I'm sort of with you. I'm not, a huge tech admirer. I'm not a big techno optimist, but we've left ourselves, you know, some pretty bad choices. So, you know, one of the chapters deals with, gene editing, and I'll give a very sort of on the ground local example. There's a pathogen that swept through all of the northeastern U.S., killed virtually every American chestnut tree in the forests of the northeast and to a certain extent southeastern U.S. The tree did go sort of, its range did stretch into sort of the northern parts of the southeastern U.S. So 4 billion trees killed off by this fungal pathogen. And now there is researchers in Syracuse have created a chestnut tree, an American chestnut tree that has a gene, a single gene, which was imported from wheat actually, that allows the chestnut tree to fight off this fungus. So here's a question. Those trees are now sitting in these fenced in plots in Syracuse. They can't be planted out on the landscape without a lot of, you know, federal permitting. And that permitting process is in fact underway right now. We don't know how it's going to go. We don't know if they will get permitted. But here's a case where our choice is basically, and I don't think this is putting it too bluntly, but it's basically between no chestnut trees in the forests of the Northeast and a gene with a chestnut tree with one, you know, one wheat gene in it. You make the call. It's not an easy call to make.
Now, I believe one of the situations you describe in your book, I have a good friend who gets very concerned about this and sends me articles every time there's there's an outbreak, and that's the Asian carp situation. And I understand that one of the things you talk about, apparently they're trying to put electric fences and maybe the Great Lakes to try to stop the Asian carp, which is basically an invasive species that rapidly displaces all other forms of fish in a lake that they enter.
Well, the Asian carp are up and down the Mississippi water system, and those electric barriers that you refer to, they're already in place. I visited them. In fact, I took a boat over them, and there are these huge signs that say, you know, keep your kids and your pets in the boat because if they stray into the water, you know, they'll get electrocuted. So those are already there. And the point of, or one of the points of them, it's a bit of a complicated story, is to keep those carp, which are, as I say, already, you know, and as your friend has pointed out to you, fantastically plentiful throughout the Mississippi water system, from entering the Great Lakes system. That's the fear.
So we've been talking with Elizabeth Colbert, author of The Sixth Extinction, but her new book out is Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. And this is Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk radio network.
There's a longer version of Mark Dunley's interview with Elizabeth Colbert on our website at mediasanctuary.org. Miss Ella Maria LeBlanc is a life coach and entrepreneur. She believes that you are amazing and you should be living your best life. Renee Powell spoke with LeBlanc about her new book, Your Path to True Freedom, 10 Principles to Guide You to Living the Life You Deserve. This also has a companion book titled Your Path to True Freedom Guided Journal.
Welcome to Lifting Voices. I am your host, Renee Powell, president of the Troy branch of the NAACP. We're celebrating Women's History Month. We're going to talk with Ms. Ella Maria LeBlanc. She's an author of a book about self-help
titled
Your Path to True Freedom, and it has a companion journal guide with it. Ella Maria LeBlanc is a life coach and entrepreneur. You can visit her website at www.queenellamaria.com. And also with us is her manager, Beverly Ivy of Events by Bev. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ella Maria, I'd like to delve a little bit more into how you come to realize that you needed to write this book.
I realized that I needed to write this book when I was hearing conversations about the younger generation being misguided or not having any guidance. I felt like I could bridge the gap between the younger generations and the older generations. The older generations would say, you know, the younger generations doesn't have some of the family values or work ethics that they have. And being a millennial, I thought I could relate. I thought I could bridge the gap because I can relate to both. I definitely have those family values from the, you know, the baby boomer generations embedded in me. And, you know, that was taught to me. But I also feel like I'm still young enough where I can still connect and speak the language of the younger generations and that I could be a guide for them.
I had an opportunity to read some of your book. My favorite chapters were chapter one, where you talk about start with self, and you talk about self-love, and we're not talking about that superficial taking selfies and looking in the mirror. And then being part of the NAACP, chapter nine hit home, and that's serve your community. How did you come up with these various topics that you selected to cover?
Well, I was thinking about, as I said, I was thinking about, you know, what is it about the younger generation that these older generations feel they're misguided on or that they lack guidance. And I tried to think of, you know, different topics and different principles that were, like I said, taught to me and embedded in me, and what I felt was important to share with especially the younger generations. So that definitely, you know, played a big role in what I decided to choose, as well as because I am a certified life coach, I also drew from that as well and incorporated that into the book.
And I'm quite sure your services are used extensively as a life coach.
That was recent. I actually became a life coach in the process of writing this book. I thought that taking a course and having a background in life coaching would just be more beneficial to the book and would add, you know, some credibility as well to me and to the book. I have used my services, but more of it has been with the book and connected to the book. But I definitely have used it as far as having different workshops. I have done different workshops through my church, and I do use a lot of my things that I was taught from that course in the workshops and my upcoming workshop.
So tell me about your upcoming workshop. What is your audience for that workshop?
The workshop is through my church, Macedonia Baptist Church, and I have done a workshop previously. It's for the Women's Ministry Women Retreat. And before the pandemic, we also did a retreat, and I co-hosted a workshop for that. I believe it was a health workshop. And the audience is women of the community. So it's not just for women of Macedonia. It's for all women, all ages, all backgrounds. You know, you can go to a different church. Maybe you don't go to church at all. It's just for everyone to, you know, as women to come together and just, you know, be encouraged and to learn from one another and to help benefit each other, because we truly are a sisterhood.
To your manager, Beverly Ivy, how did you come to be a part of this? I'm going to call it not a book. This is a project here. How did you and Ella Maria connect, Beverly?
Ella Maria and I met at Macedonia, Macedonia Baptist Church, good connection and good vibes. And she would attend the women's ministry. And so I did make her aware that not only was I retired, but I also had events by Beverly. So Ella Maria approached me. She said, well, I'm writing a book. And I like how you phrase a project, because working on oneself is a project. It's self-evolving, it's ongoing. So because I am a event planner and I have MBA in marketing and those particular skills, so my realm of working with Ella Maria is the promotion. Get women to know about the book. And because of the pandemic, we have to be more intentional. How we get the word out? How do we reach the audience?
So Beverly, what has the feedback been of this project, the workshops, and now you have the book? So what kind of feedback have you gotten thus far?
I want to say the feedback has been very, very positive. We couldn't do the book signings like we have, but we were able to get the book in the hands of women at the church. And they were great, and the comments were wonderful. So people are excited about the book, about the project. And this book is seamless. The introspective of any age, a 20-year-old or 60-plus.
I did have a woman tell me that she read my entire book in one sitting. And she said that she was thinking about writing her own personal story and how my book inspired her to do so. And some other feedback I've gotten was, some of my more mature readers said that they've read the book and after reading it, they've passed it along to some younger women who they feel could benefit from the book.
That is awesome. Ella Maria, what do you like to do when you're not writing?
Well, actually, when I'm not writing, I do have a soap, handmade soap making business. And I make handmade decorative shea butter soaps and designs. And I really enjoy doing that. And they're actually available for sale on Etsy. It's my website is ellamariaboutique.etsy.com.
So in writing this book and doing this project, what would you say was one of the most memorable events? Are there any other memorable events that have occurred during this writing process?
As far as, well, during the writing process, while I was still in the, you know, before the book was published, I realized that, you know, I've always considered myself to be a confident woman and to take chances, but there are some personal stories that I share in the book that I never intended to share with the public. And through writing this, I had to share it if I wanted to truly inspire others, which I set out to do. And I prayed about it. I cried about it. And I really did not want to share some of the stories I did share. But like I said, to be on your true path, your path to true freedom, I had to do that. That was something I had to overcome. So I think that was the most memorable for me, is the fact that this book drew a very personal and maybe dark time in my life out of me, so that I'm not weighed down by it anymore.
Wow, that is awesome and very deep. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that and for sharing your story with us in the book.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. You will definitely see more and hear more of Ella Maria.
www.macedoniaofalbany.org.
QueenEllaMaria.com. And if anyone would like to purchase the book or the journal, that's available on Amazon. And as I said, my shea butter soaps are available on Etsy.
This has been awesome. Thank you so much. Ella Maria LeBlanc and Beverly Ivy, we look forward to hearing more great things from Ella Maria.
Yes, definitely. Thank you.
That was Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Renee Powell speaking with author Miss Ella Maria LeBlanc and her manager, Beverly Ivy. For those of you just tuning in, I'm Sina Bazila Hickey, and you are listening to a special episode about authors on Hudson Mohawk Magazine. On the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WOOGLP 92.7 FM in Troy, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community, for the community, and is supported by independent donations. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. Hudson Talbot's newest book, A Walk in the Words, is his own story about how he turned the challenge of being a slow reader to his advantage. By getting his curiosity and love of language leading him into reading, he became a storyteller himself and discovered that he could paint with words. Here he speaks with Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Andrea Cunliffe.
It's all about meow. It's a river of dreams. It's the tales of King Arthur. It's Leonardo's horse. It's dinosaurs. It's into the woods. And it's a walk in the words. Hudson Talbot's the author and the illustrator of these amazing books, 27 in all. Hudson lives just south of the capital region. And so he's a Hudson Valley resident. Hello, Hudson. Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. Andrea, it's nice to be here with you.
I know that you're a writer and an illustrator, and someone had even mentioned they thought that you were a cartoonist. How do you describe your art?
Basically, it's all devoted to illustration now for my books. I do these books that I write and illustrate and design from cover to cover. And I get somebody else to pay for them. So it's great. You know, my publisher is Random House. So they've got enough money to pay for them. And I've made them a little money too. That's how it works here. You know, if you want to get republished again. But no, they've been wonderful to me. I've been with the same editor there for many years. And it's a great relationship. But basically how I describe myself is an author and illustrator.
A storyteller. Hudson's newest book, A Walk in the Words, your own story about a struggle you had as a boy.
It is my own story. It's the first time I've done anything that's truly directly autobiographical where I really speak in first person, you know, using I rather than he or she even. I've done some books with the female characters, the main one. Any author will tell you everything you do is a little bit autobiographical. But this one really is my story of my struggle with learning to read, being the slowest reader in the class, long before there was such a word as dyslexia in common usage. I certainly never heard it. Nobody at all was being diagnosed with it back in those days. The stigma is that if you're a slow reader, it just means you're slow altogether. It became my secret. You know, I learned how to make it look like I could read, and I'd see a big block of text on a page and I could read the first sentence and sort of a few in the middle and then some at the bottom and hopefully would not get caught. As all the other kids were turning the page, you know, to the next one, I still hadn't even finished the first one. I carried that secret with me for a long time. I mean, in some ways, you know, even though I've overcome it, you could say in many ways, something like that lives on in a person. And that's really my motivation for doing this book, because I don't want any kids who had the same struggle or having the same struggle to live with that sense of shame that I did, you know, for my young life. There's no reason for it. We all should be entitled and feel deserving of reading at our own pace and doing things that we love to do the way we do them. You know, we're all individuals, and I guess that's what I would like to use this story for, to extrapolate. I hope that people and kids will feel like this is something that's applicable to me, that I am an individual. I have the right to be who I am, the way I am. I might be good at sports. I might be good at music. I might not be so good at this thing or that thing. So what? That's me. That's my package. You become whole eventually in life when you know how to own your strengths and your weaknesses. It certainly did not stop me, not just from the joy of reading, playing with words, but from becoming a storyteller, from writing my stories. You know, that's what led me to where I am today.
I read that you began to tell stories using pictures rather than using words, and that was sort of the connection between learning more words and learning how to use words, as well as combining that with the ability to tell a story in a more abstract way.
What I did looking back, I always loved stories. Everybody does. You know, I loved to be read a story. I love hearing stories. And I was really wanting to tell stories, and I did it through drawing pictures, as so many kids do. And as I continued to do that, I was starting to realize that I could do better or more completely if I could use words. So I actually started using words in my writing to tell stories. That led me to reading more, to find good words that would be good in my stories. And like if I wanted to do a story about a horse, which was a very common thing for me, I loved horses. And so I read books like King of the Wind and The Black Stallion and stories about horses, just getting lost in the story, not thinking that I'm reading. I just wanted to know what happened next in the story. So sort of like it was in some ways kind of a backdoor into reading, learning to enjoy words and language and putting them together. And it's like alchemy, you know, you put certain words together and you've got magic. That's what I'm always trying for when I'm doing any book right now.
So you've done 27 books. You did other things as well.
Oh, I've done lots of other things, but drawing and art and making art's always been a constant for me. Certainly as far back as I can remember, I was bringing home drawings or even doing them on our living room floor and my mom putting them up on the fridge, you know, with a magnet or whatever. And, you know, and then eventually becoming like the quote unquote class artist, you know, when I was a teenager, writing very different story. I really didn't come into writing. I wrote privately for myself, but I never showed that to anybody. I loved writing because, again, it was another form of expression. I had that impulse. I had that drive to express myself. It really wasn't until I was about 35 years old that I had a very lucky break. Doesn't usually happen this way. A children's book editor in New York City saw some of my illustration, a calendar that I'd done in Barnes & Noble, and just thought he'd try finding me. He looked me up in the Manhattan phone book. There I was. I was in his office the next day. And he said, how would you like to try to write an illustrated children's book? And I said, well, illustration, I've got that down. Writing, you need to understand, I'm barely literate. So he said, don't worry, why don't you give it a shot? We can always call in a writer if it doesn't work out. That was 30 books ago. Did that. That was my first book. It was a hit. They were going back to press before it was even out on the bookshelves. And Steven Spielberg picked it up and made it into an animated feature-length film.
Which one was that?
It was called We're Back, A Dinosaur Story. It came out in the early 90s. I was very lucky and very fortunate and very grateful for having such a great start right away. It doesn't usually go that way for people.
But you really love travel as well. You've got Amazon Diary and Safari Journal. Those were two books that you based on your travels. They're not really considered totally children's books, are they?
Oh, well, you know, that's a funny thing that you're mentioning because I have discovered that a lot of adults love children's books. Yes. And frequently I will get people that if I'm signing books and in a line, you know, of buyers waiting to have their book signed, they might come to me with a couple of books and one, they'll say, well, this one's for my grandchildren and this one's for me. Or sometimes not even that. They'll say, no, there's certain books that I just like and they happen to be children's books. I don't care. I love the pictures. I love the story. I'm flattered. I'm honored that somebody would feel that way. I do. I absolutely do. That's what made me want to get into it. When I lived in New York, there was a wonderful bookstore, still is there, called Books of Wonder. And they had the best children's books, beautiful, individual, creative books with these wonderful, very imaginative illustrations. I always thought, you know, if I ever did children's books, I'd like to be in that store. And they were one of my first places where I signed books many years later.
Fantastic. Travel does have a great deal to do with your life and with what you find enlightening and expanding. But you're wonderful with the local information as well. I mean, the River of Dreams, the story of the Hudson River, is right here. We can see it right out the window. An exciting book as well.
Well, thank you. You know, in later life, after my travels and living in the city for many years, I decided to settle down in the Hudson Valley. I love it here. And eventually, you know, I got to thinking that my name, Hudson, Hudson River, Hudson Valley, the city of Hudson, maybe there's a book, maybe something's telling me I need to do a book about this. And so that's where the River of Dreams came from. It's the story of the Hudson Valley based on the dreamers who always were led here, including myself. It starts with me as a little kid dreaming about going to New York, ultimately up the Hudson River, following the dreamers like Henry Hudson and Robert Fulton and Pete Seeger, you know, was one of the great people who inspired dreamers, you know, with all of his great music and helping to start the environmental movement.
It's been made into a stage play. The students up and down the Hudson Valley.
It's called River of Dreams. If anybody's interested, I would be happy to pass on information about how school could produce that. I am so lucky that one of my best buddies, Frank Cuthbert, is also a gifted singer and songwriter, and he composed the music for River of Dreams. It's wonderful. It's been produced now many times. We'll be again in the spring at Hudson Hall in Hudson, New York. It's an after-school project called the Hudson Harmony Project, an after-school program where they learn to sing and perform and entertain kids who are drawn to being on stage.
What have you got coming up next?
Well, I am starting another book. My editor is patiently waiting. Right now, I'm still doing the PR for A Walk in the Words, but I do have another book in the wings. You know what I always love to tell kids, you know, when they ask me, where do you get your ideas from? It's always, you know, write what you know, write what you love. I like to say, write what you're curious about. All of these things that I've ever done have always been because I was curious about it. And the project that I've got started is something that I've always been wonderfully curious about. I love doing the research. It's so much fun to get immersed in learning about something so I can write about it. What can I tell you? It has to do with stars and astrology. That's as much as I'll say.
That'll be a good one. I can't wait. This has been Andrea Cunliffe for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Hudson Talbot has written and illustrated over 27 books for young readers. His books have been made into films, musicals, and have won several awards, including a Newbery Honor. And there is a longer version to this interview by Andrea Cunliffe on our website. Angela Kaufman, a local author, talks to Eileen Javier about her novel Quiet Man, a crime drama that explores the exploitation of working people, animals, and the environment under a predatory capitalist system.
This is Eileen Javier for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and we're here today with Angela Kaufman. She is a licensed clinical social worker, a certified intuitive consultant, a psychic medium, an activist, and an author. What's going on, Angela? How are you?
Hi, I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks. So you have dedicated your life to your interest in spirituality and social justice. And you have co-authored 3 books that speak about metaphysical and spiritual topics. But in your new novel, Quiet Men, this is a totally different route. This is a crime drama that explores the damages caused by capitalism and the meat industry and how this affects not only people, animals, but also our environment. What made you want to write Quiet Men?
Well, you're absolutely right. It was a big change from what I'd written in the past. So back in the summer of 2016, I had been vegan at that point for a little over a year. And I read a great book called Slaughterhouse by Gail Eisnitz. And this book that I read was an expose of the slaughter industry. And she talked a lot about the exploitation of workers, not only the horrible things that happened to the non-human animals. And I remember I finished the book, I closed it, and my first thought was, how does everybody not know this? How do I make everybody know this? So in this kind of grandiose way, I had this idea that, like, hey, what if I write a book, but it's fiction, and so people will read it because they want to, you know, go along with the story. But in the process of reading the story, they'll learn about, you know, basically the things I had just learned about the meat industry. And that's not really a new idea. It was something that Upton Sinclair did back in the early 1900s with his book The Jungle. But I thought, what if I wrote this book and set it in the present day and, you know, let people know that things have actually gotten worse in this industry since Upton Sinclair's book led to the first regulations of the industry, and then we've backslid tremendously since then. And the thought occurred to me to write this story. And I figured, you know, in order for it to have an impact, we've got to have the main character has to be the most bland, boring person you can imagine. And his life has to be so dramatically changed by his work in the slaughterhouse that he ends up committing, you know, a pretty horrific, violent act, but it has to be against a human. So I thought, well, if it's really going to stand out, this can't just be anything. It has to be intense and taboo and horrible. And so in the very beginning of the book, you find out that the protagonist, whose name is Colin, is starting to lose his grip on reality, and he thinks he's still at work. He thinks he's still in the slaughterhouse, but he's actually at home, and he ends up lashing out against his child, and the results are you know, fatal. He ends up killing his son. And then as you read the full story, you come to understand the kinds of things that Colin and his coworkers were exposed to every single day in their work in the slaughter industry. And my hope was that, you know, people would read this and would think to themselves, like, okay, I'm glad this isn't true. And then they'd get to the end and find out that some of this actually is based on real experiences, and maybe they'd reconsider eating meat, or at the very least, you can't unknow something once you know it. So if someone continues to patronize this industry, at least they would do so knowing what they're supporting.
There are some disturbing things that happen in this story. Was it hard to write these scenes? Why you think it was important to portray these examples of abuse in the book?
Yeah, it was incredibly hard. I mean, like you said, my writing is like, you know, spiritual self-help books, and then, you know, not only to leap to a new genre, but it was very hard because in order to tell the story, I need it to seem real, and I need those scenes to play out in my own head first, and then I need my reader to also enter this world. In order to do it justice, I needed the scenes to seem realistic, but at the same time, I also kind of wanted to protect readers against, you know, like, I don't want to make people feel bad, but in order for this to hit home, you know, we've got to pull the curtain back and expose what goes on. And this is a world that our society intentionally pushes into the background. You know, we take great measures to not see this world. So balancing between doing justice to the reality, but also being sensitive to the reader and wanting to not scare them away so that they'll stick around and keep reading. And as they keep reading, more and more is unraveled. And when all is said and done, there's actually very few scenes in the book that take place in the slaughterhouse, but the scenes that are shown are very intentional. I tried to make them brief in comparison to the whole book. And there's a point that is made in each scene. So it's not just gratuitous, over-the-top violence. You know, and the attention is that the reader gets into the scene and thinks to themselves, thank God this is just a story because this is really sick. And then they get to the end of the book and read the afterword and learn that these types of depictions are absolutely based on factual occurrences.
So we will be able to know
when you get to the afterword. So when you're reading the story, I mean, it is a novel, so the idea is that, you know, people think they're reading a story that's all made up. When you get to the end, there's an afterword, and in the afterword, I delineate. So, for example, the storyline is fiction, including the town, Mosier, North Carolina, that to my knowledge does not exist. The company, Monarch Industries, doesn't exist, but it is based on your standard giant food processing plants like Smithfield and Tyson and those kind of places. The exact characters, for the most part, are fictional. They make reference to the Trump, you know, election of 2016. So like those things are reality. And so the storyline is made up, but anytime that there's a scene in a slaughterhouse and there's like really awful things happening, that's based on undercover investigations and things that I've read where people have depicted not only abuse against the animals, but also things like sexual abuse, like really over the top abuse and exploitation of employees, rampant racism, sexism, discrimination against immigrant workers in particular. There's a couple of scenes where the protagonist's attorney, Cam, is trying to understand the nature of slaughter work, and he interviews different people. And so there are some scenes where these characters talk about the history of the slaughter industry, and those are based on factual accounts. I've changed some of the names, but, you know, basically anything related to the history of the industry and union busting in the industry, that's all factual. The practices in the industry, including the fact that 1,300 pigs every hour or more are slaughtered every day, that is factual. And in fact, that number is probably higher now because there's been further dysregulation since the book was written. But so those parts are factual.
And how do you hope that Quiet Men change the misconception that people have about slaughter and the meat industry?
Well, there's this idea that there's a humane way to kill anyone, an animal, you know, anyone. And I'm sorry, but we just don't do that. Like, I could beg you right now to take my life, and you would never do that. And even if you wanted to, the law wouldn't support you doing that with good reason. So the idea that it's sold to us that these like smiling happy cows or smiling pigs on the lush green pastures, you know, that's what our packaging in this industry tells us. And that's, you know, when you go and buy a burger or pork chops, we have these images of these happy animals, and the idea of, you know, humanely raising an animal and then killing them, that there's any reverence in that, that idea is ridiculous. The idea that an animal can be, you know, raised humanely and end up on your plate in a cruelty-free way is absurd. Because even in the best case scenario, even if an animal is treated like royalty, what happens to them between pasture and getting on the plate is hell on earth. And one of the misconceptions is that there's a way to kind of softly kill an animal, and that's not accurate. And also the misconception that slaughter is only cruel for the non-human animals. And this is an industry that actively seeks out and preys upon the most vulnerable people who need work to survive and have few other options. And so I'm hoping that Quiet Man brings people into this very uncomfortable world that we push way out to the outskirts of society, and shows them that, you know, in the eyes of these major slaughter operations, the human worker is regarded little better than the pig being sent to slaughter. And even though Quiet Man is fiction, here we are in 2020, and the pandemic has brought this point to the surface at a time when we've basically said, let's sacrifice working people, including slaughterhouse workers, and we get this tiny glimpse of just how poorly their lives are regarded.
Quiet Man brings up so many social problems. How do you think they're connected?
So somewhere in the book, I'll paraphrase, I wrote something to the effect that slaughter is the butt to every universal rule that we're taught since childhood. So we're taught, you know, treat others the way we want to be treated, but all beings are equal, but thou shalt not kill, but. And if we make these exceptions to morality on these one specific occasion, you know, say because it's a non-human animal, or because we're harming or exploiting someone who has a different class or rank or doesn't share social or racial privilege, you know, once we make this one exception to these basic rules of morality and these basic rules of not harming others, we open a door. And throughout history, we've seen how people can compel others to do horrible things by using the designation animal to dehumanize and to give someone else the status of other. And this industry is all about othering. It's like warfare. It's like the prison complex. You get to tell yourself that you're better, more worthy, more valid than the person or animal you're interacting with in order to fulfill the duties of your job. If you work in the meat industry, for example, or even if you take part in this industry as a consumer, which is something we all do or have done to some extent. So this is the harsh look in the mirror at how much we really do value our ideals, or to what extent we're willing to chip away at them to make these exceptions out of convenience or for profit. And the motive on the high end of the proverbial food chain is huge profit. And on the low end, it's survival. So again, you have slaughter as the most accurate, I think, model of the predatory nature of capitalism, and the way that those with fewer choices are forced into the dirtiest and most dangerous and degrading work. So we have this underlying attitude of, I'm up here, you're down there, and I can treat you however I want. And this is the underlying attitude behind racism, classism, misogyny, rape culture, and capitalism, and in the military and prison industrial complex. And it certainly is inherent in our attitude toward non-human animals, and that's represented by the meat industry in this book.
And what role do you think artists, you as a writer, and also more creative people have in creating social change?
I think now a more important role than ever, and like especially the last 4 years have really taught us that, opening the door for a lot of activists and artists to discover that getting your message out isn't just about attending rallies. We have a number of gifts and can use them all to create change and awareness. And I think the arts in particular, this last year with the pandemic, you know, so many of us being deprived of those experiences of going to theater, going to art galleries and things like that, I think there's a real craving for the humanities and for the arts. And this is a really great moment for artists and creators out there to bring these two worlds of art and activism together.
Where can people buy Quiet Man?
Currently available mostly online for now. And so there's the standard Amazon, barnesandnoble.com, but I highly recommend and encourage a website called indiebound.org. So it's IndieBound.org. And that's a website where you can enter your zip code and they'll list the independent bookstores in your area that can order the book for you.
Will you be doing a book tour via Zoom? How will that be able to work with the pandemic?
Good question. I am looking for and open to and trying to line up as many ways to get the message out there as possible, but it is going to be virtual. I'm not confident that things are going to be at a level where I'll be back doing in-person book signings and that kind of thing anytime soon, but I'm very happy to share the message. And so I'm looking for opportunities to blog or do podcast interviews like this to help get the word out. And maybe in a couple years when we're in a better place collectively, there'll be more opportunities opportunity for physical tours.
Thank you so much for giving us your time today, Angela.
Oh, thank you so much.
That was Angela Kaufman speaking with Eileen Javier about her novel, Quiet Man. Finally, we hear from author Ashley Charleston, who spoke with Dulcinea Diggs. The book, Nyasia's Beautiful Discovery, is in honor of her niece, Nyasia. The interview took place at A Girls Inc. event back in May.
Hello, this is HM correspondent Dulcinea Diggs, and I'm here at the Girls Inc. event in Albany. Today, I'm speaking with the author, Ashley Charleston. She is here to support Girls Inc. and read her book to the young ladies here at Girls Inc. Please welcome my guest, Ashley Charleston. How are you doing today?
I'm excellent. Thank you for asking.
Of course. What is your background?
My background, one, I am a teacher. I was able to get my education at SUNY Albany, where I studied English. And then I got my master's at the illustrious North Carolina A&T, where I studied English and African American lit.
And what was it like studying African American literature?
It was a beautiful experience. I got to learn a lot about myself. I got to learn about my heritage, and I got to connect with a lot of wonderful people and learn just how many contributions African American people have had in the world of literature, the world of writing, and it was a great experience.
So you're a teacher, right?
I am.
Now please tell me, why did you become an ELA teacher?
I became an ELA teacher because I think it's so important for students all over the globe, but here in America, to be able to write themselves into existence. I think that students need an opportunity to know that their voice needs to be heard, their voice matters, and there's no better way than to put it in writing because your writing will outlast you even when you're not here.
Definitely, definitely. So, what are some of the pros and cons of being an ELA teacher?
A lot of pros. You have the opportunity to be influential in the lives of youth. You have an opportunity to teach students to be citizen scholars, to know that outside of school, they have so many opportunities to connect to their communities, connect to people that look like them, who don't look like them, and to help them with their writing and know that, you know, words matter, words count. And reading and writing are just fundamental things that you need to be able to do, and it could be fun. You know, some cons, very little cons. You know, sometimes right now we're in a pandemic, so a lot of students, they don't turn their cameras on. You have students who are not coming into school, so you don't have an opportunity to have that hands-on, one-on-one experience. But hopefully, you know, next school year, I'll have an opportunity to see more smiling faces inside of the actual physical classroom.
And how have you been able to make it, I guess you could say, bearable?
Well, every day, just coming in with a great attitude, just letting students know, like, I'm here for you. You know, smiling, just, you know, positivity, and just, you know, being that teacher that lets students know, like, okay, if you don't know an answer, if you need help, just let me know. And, you know, being that person, putting on a little bit of music, you know, in Zoom chat, just constantly reminding students, like, you know, this is a page we're on, sharing the text, and just getting voices heard. In the beginning of school, I would do a lot of the reading, but now it's like, okay, we need different parts. I need you to be the Cyclops. I need you to be Odysseus. I need you to be Circe. Just letting the students know that, all right, we need some different parts. I need you guys to act these roles out. Let's make this happen.
Now, do you think your students have gotten used to the pandemic? And if so, how is it affecting their schoolwork?
Unfortunately, I think they have gotten used to it. I hope that is something that we never have to get used to again. A lot of students I know are struggling with depression. You know, a lot of adults are struggling with depression, and that's a big thing. You know, you have students that, you know, the parents have said, like, my child went from being outgoing, my child went from, you know, bubbly and connecting to school, connecting to friends, to now they don't want to be on camera, you know, they don't want to do their work. All they want to do is sleep. All they want to do is be on Roblox. All they want to do is, you know, be on video games. And, you know, it's very sad.
Definitely, definitely. They love those Roblox for sure.
They do. They do.
So please tell us, what is your relationship to Girls Inc.?
Girls Inc. and I, we go way, way back. So Girls Inc. was a place where I got my start as a young girl back in third grade. Girls Inc. is Schenectady. Shout out to Girls Inc., the Greater Capital Region. It was a place where I used to go after school. I was fortunate enough to take Taekwondo, fortunate enough to go to camp, fortunate enough to even name Creation Station. And then as I got older, I was able to work at Girls Inc. while going to college and all of that beautiful stuff. And now here I am, life comes full circle.
Now, can you tell us more about Creation Station? What is that about?
Well, when I first started Girls Inc., we had a place called the Game Room. And there was a contest where one of the girls got to name the game room something else. And I just put, you know, a name in the hat And then people picked it, and it went from the game room to Creation Station. So when I came to this beautiful building here in Albany and see that they had Creation Station, I'm like, wow, instead of it being game room, it's now Creation Station. It's just, when I think about it, it's like all these moving parts together, and I just see girls creating and being their best selves and just working together in that space. And it has withstood the test of time. Like, I'm not going to give my age away, but it's been many, many years. So that excites me.
It's like watching your dreams come true a little bit, no?
Watching my dreams come true, you know, from childhood to adulthood.
Definitely. Okay, what is Nyasia's beautiful discovery all about?
I love that energy. Nyasia's beautiful discovery, it was actually written with my niece, Nyasia. Shout out to Nyasia. It's about a young girl's journey from being fearful to finding the courage to not be fearful working with a friend. You know, this friend helps her overcome her fear, and that's what she'll find out in the book. It's like, how does this happen? What does this friend do? How does Nyasia overcome her fear? And that's, you know, basically sums up the book.
Now, I was taking a couple previews of the book. Nyasia is multicultural, no?
Nyasia is multicultural. Nyasia is African-American and a Puerto Rican young lady. She has a black belt in Taekwondo. And again, that's my wonderful niece.
Wow. So you took her story and just ran with it, right?
I took her story and ran with it. I think, again, it's important that we're leaving legacies for the children in our families. Even though she's not my daughter, she's my niece. And I think that this will be something that she'll be able to look back on and know that I'm an author. You know, I can put this down on my college resume. I can tell my friends about it, and I can build on this. And even if my life, I feel like it might not be my best day, I might not be my happiest, I can look back at this and know that this is something I did with my aunt. This is something that puts a smile on my face, and it touches people that I may never get to know.
Definitely, definitely. Kids don't realize the impact they could have by doing something like writing a book.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay, so what would you say to the young lady listening to this right now?
I would tell the young lady listening to this right now, you're a queen. You know, your power is on the inside, and you have the power to do anything that you put your mind to. You know, if that means write, if that means run, if that means draw, do whatever it is that is going to be the best for you at the time, and just keep pushing. But just know that you're a queen, no matter where you are at this point in your life.
Beautiful. Well said. Okay. Now tell us, do you have any final words?
I just thank you for this interview. And again, my book is available on Amazon. It's available on Barnes & Noble. It's Nyasia's Beautiful Discovery. Check it out. You know, a lot of students have, you know, told me that they got over their fear of bugs. They've learned to, you know, trust nature a little bit more. And it puts smiles on kids' faces. And it made me happy. So hopefully it'll make you happy as well.
Definitely, definitely. And how can the public see more of you? You have Instagram, Facebook, you know?
Yeah, so check me out on Instagram, sisauthoress, sisauthoress. I actually also have an author page on Facebook, Ashley Charleston. Check me out there as well. And I'm available. Come find me.
All right, folks. Well, I just spoke with the lovely Ashley Charleston. Be sure to check out her book, Nyasia's Beautiful Discovery. Thanks so much, Ashley.
Thank you.
That was Dulcinea Diggs speaking with author Ashley Charleston. And that title, Beautiful, is spelled B-E-E-utiful. Beautiful. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. We have more interviews with authors on our website. I'm Sina Bazila Hickey. Our content is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Thank you to all of our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.